We are at the start of the sixth major extinction of life on Earth.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. NASA just declared 2009 the second hottest year since modern measurements began in 1880. The warmest year was 2005, and the past decade was the warmest on record. Global climate change is upon us. In this program, you'll hear two of the world's top authorities explain how this will impact our health and the survival of all the species. I'll interview Dr. Jonathan Patz, a physician and lead author for the IPCC, on health and climate change. He is now advising emergency doctors and disaster agencies on what to expect as climate disruption proceeds. Then we'll go straight to Paris for a speech by Thomas Lovejoy, the inventor of the term biological diversity. His speech, recorded January 25, 2010, opened a United Nations conference to celebrate this year of biodiversity. But Lovejoy warns we're entering the sixth great extinction. Don't miss this powerful overview on climate change and the species in our second half hour. Our guest is Dr. Jonathan Patz, Professor of Environmental Studies and Population Health Sciences at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has been a lead author on IPCC reports as well. Dr. Patz, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Alex.
In 2009, you gave a talk at the 16th World Congress on Disaster and Emergency Medicine where you predicted both foreboding clouds and silver linings when it comes to global climate change and health. Can we start with the clouds? What sits near the top of the list of new worries?
Well, the challenge of climate change is that it can affect not only our ecosystems and the world around us, but it can affect our own health. And as a public health issue, climate change can affect us through so many different pathways that I view this as an enormous health challenge. For example, we all know about problems of direct effects of heat waves and of storms. These are certainly climatic risks that we know about. But there are some even broader issues like the effect of on agriculture and nutrition from extremes in climate around the world. So those are some problems with food shortages. And then many diseases are climate sensitive. Diseases carried by mosquitoes, for example, like malaria or dengue fever. These are all very climate sensitive, and many of the models are showing that these types of diseases will increase under scenarios of global warming. One other item, not just temperature, but the climatologists tell us that as Earth warms, we'll have a much more dynamic hydrologic cycle, so water cycle, so more floods and more droughts. And if that's the case, then we may have problems with contaminated water and waterborne diseases as well. So this is why I think that climate change represents such a different and large health issue, because it crosses many different types of illnesses and can affect us not just through one pathway, but from many pathways.
Well, it is so complicated because we're dealing with all the different species that interlock, and some of them end up impacting humans especially. I wanted to talk about malaria and dengue fever just a little bit. Is it going to, as the models project, will it affect more people in the third world, as we call it, or is it also going to spread into new areas where we hadn't seen it before?
Alex, that's a tricky question. We do know that diseases like malaria, they are temperature limited. So in other words, the parasite cannot even develop inside the mosquito unless it's warm enough, which is why it's a tropical disease. So there are models that show malaria will increase in its transmission season, so that the mosquitoes may be transmitting over a longer period, the intensity of transmission such that mosquitoes become infectious more quickly under warm and humid conditions. So these are things that are fairly well documented, and we understand these. Now, regarding movement of disease into a different geography, that's a little trickier because, of course, diseases and climate and environmental risks happen in the context of human society and infrastructure and our capacity to adapt, for example. If a disease moves from a poor country with not very good housing, no screens on windows, and not much health infrastructure, and may move poleward towards cooler climates, if they cross the boundary into a wealthy country that has better infrastructure, of course, you know, you have to take that into account. So I think the potential and the risk of diseases moving geographically is definitely real. The question is, you know, will we really see these diseases or not? That's up for grabs, and it may be that we spend more money on preventing them, and we need to spend more money to prevent some of these diseases as they increase in risk, but I'm not sure whether or not they'll actually appear.
Will climate changes imperil people, for example, in North America, or is it just a problem for people in faraway places?
Well, certainly in North America, we already have people dying in heat waves. The Chicago heat wave in 95, you saw over 700 people dying in that one event. And we continue to have mortality and hospitalizations from heat waves. So that's something that could be exacerbated with climate change, and that's the likelihood. The other thing is that there are still millions of Americans that live in counties where the air quality is not meeting the EPA standards. So air pollution is a problem in North America and in our country. And the projections for climate change are not good in that air quality can be affected in two ways. One, that with warmer temperatures, you change the atmospheric chemistry such that you can have more ground-level ozone formation, you know, smog ozone. That could be a problem. The climate models also show more stagnant air masses in the future, so that, you know, not only may you have issues with atmospheric chemistry, but also the dynamics and winds and things like that, you could have more stagnant air masses and therefore pollution issues. So those are things that affect us. And I especially think for my region of the U.S. in the upper Midwest, in the Great Lakes region, you know, we have a lot of issues right now with handling of rainfall runoff and contaminated water systems. And in fact, across the United States, there are still over 700 communities that combine their storm water with sewage simply from, you know, the design of their combined sewer system. And it's very expensive to fix that now. So we experience these combined sewage overflow events every year already in this country. The projections are for increases in intense rainfall events. We've done some modeling, and in this region, in Wisconsin, we may see upwards of a 40% increase in heavy rainfall events that, of course, would stress our water systems and our water infrastructure. So I think these issues of heavy rainfall patterns and water contamination, air pollution, and heat waves definitely are of high relevance in the United States. And one other quick caveat about malaria increasing and places where developing countries may be hit very hard from climate change. We live in a globalized world, and increases in disease anywhere really do have the potential to come back and affect every country in the world. So back in the old days, before we had international travel and transport, you know, maybe it was a different story, but we're really very interconnected these days.
As we've just seen with some of the epidemics that have happened, I want to move to the ocean as well. I noticed in one report that you did, I mean, we've just seen NASA recently report record warm ocean temperatures, and that affects all the sea creatures. But you've said that that could have some blowback effect on our own health, especially with our food.
You know, this is an interesting scenario that warmer sea surface temperatures could affect all sorts of issues, from generating storms to sea level rise and issues like that. One thing that I think is very concerning regarding nutrition is if our fisheries, they're in jeopardy, that would really subject many populations to protein malnutrition. The scariest thought for me is the acidification of the ocean. Now, this is something that I am not an expert in, but I've heard other people that have, they share a concern that because much of the CO2 that is increasing in the atmosphere is absorbed in the ocean, that acidifies the ocean. And if that happens to some extent, you know, there's a point where coral reefs will start dying and we'll lose our fisheries. That's a scary thought to me. Again, I'm not, you know, I know these are scenarios, and other people can speak to this topic better than I can, but I've seen there's a concern there, and certainly for me in public health, if we lose coral reefs in our fisheries, that's not a good thing for our population health.
Around the world, this is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Patz about the intricate ways our health is linked to changes in the climate. Well, Dr. Patz, as you know, James Lovelock has predicted massive human migration as the world warms. I wonder, what are the health impacts that physicians in the future may have to look for when that happens?
Well, when you think about sea level rise and storm surges, droughts and famine, that's going to displace a lot of people. You know, people are going to be on the move, either from coastal areas or from drought-ridden locations. And that issue of sort of environmentally forced refugees, that could be a very disruptive in terms of public health. And in fact, it may even be the iceberg under the tip of the iceberg when we think about, you know, massive public health challenges. This is one, you know, displaced populations because of these environmental extremes could be extremely serious. It's very hard to quantify those. Take in point the famine that hit North Korea a few years back. People were arguing, what was the most significant? Was it the extreme drought or the inflexibility of the government that sort of really propelled this disaster? And of course, it's both, and to sort of disentangle that is difficult. But I do think that issue of environmentally forced refugees is very could become a major issue.
And I suppose, too, that we don't really know how climate is going to affect agriculture. It might help it in some areas and hurt it in many others. But if there are food shortages or malnutrition, of course, that shows up as health emergencies.
Yes, and you know, you make a good point. There, with climate change, there are probably going to be some winners and some losers. The former Soviet Union may get a longer growing season, and they may fare well for a while with agriculture. But it's places that are already water restricted and places that already have problems where the climatologists predict that things will be exacerbated by climate change.
What are some of the things that we don't know about health and climate change? Where are the rich areas that need more research?
Well, certainly there are so many diseases sensitive to climate, be they the vector-borne diseases, water-borne diseases, and air pollution as well. There are a couple key areas that we really need to increase our knowledge. Regarding air pollution, we understand that warmer temperatures and more stagnant air masses definitely would pose a problem with more ground-level smog ozone pollution. What we really need more work on, though, is particulate air pollution. So let's just assume that emissions are constant. How will change climate conditions affect particle formation and that type of issue? Because particulate air pollution, the fine particles, are very dangerous. We don't have as good knowledge on the particulate air pollution modeling as we do with the ozone. for infectious diseases. We know the ecology of many vector-borne diseases, and the vector-borne diseases are the most sensitive to environmental conditions because they, unlike a directly transmitted disease that goes from one person to the next, these are diseases that go through a cold-blooded insect like a mosquito that's subjected to environmental conditions and then passes the disease to the next person. We really need to know more about disease ecology than we do today. So that's another big area. And finally, the capacity to adapt to these changes is something that we also need to look at. For example, when you think about rainfall and runoff, there are so many cities in this country, in the U.S., that have rusting pipes and failing water systems. We need to know how bad it is. I mean, we don't in many cases. There have been some trials where you put some dye down into a well, and you find the stuff, you know, maybe you put it in a sewage pipe, and you find the stuff in drinking water later. You know, there are lots of, you know, these infrastructural issues that we don't really know what our baseline is. And if we're going to put more strain through climate extremes on a water system of a city, it would be nice to know what the baseline, what the status of that system is right now.
And it looks like some cities may not have a water supply. When we look at what happened in Atlanta or out in the West there where it's drying out, that's another problem too.
Sure. Water quality and quantity.
Yeah. Well, what are the silver linings, the possible benefits of this challenge that's coming up to us?
Right. Well, I think there are some tremendous opportunities here. For example, just take the urban environment, for example. In our country, 60% of Americans do not get the minimum recommended level of exercise every day. This is, you know, from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Obesity has been pegged as our number one epidemic in this country. And so we have their nutritional issues, but I think in many cases the way we have designed our cities around the automobile rather than around people and people on bicycles has made us an unhealthy population in many cases. And so considering that transportation represents one-third of greenhouse gas emissions, if we were to green transportation and have truly multimodal transportation where people really would have a choice to take mass transit or ride a bike or walk somewhere, we would be a healthier population for it. And I think when you look at American cities, and if you were to take climate change and really mitigate emissions from automobiles and reduce our automobiles and try to have other options, we would have tremendous benefit from the exercise opportunities. And people can sign up and go to a gym and pay a lot of money, and many of us do that because we have to. But if we were to make, have this opportunity for, you know, in a daily routine like commuting to work, this could be extremely beneficial. In addition, of course, if you were to replace automobiles with bicycles or a few buses or some trains, you would greatly benefit from the reduced air pollution in urban areas. So here's a case where even if climate change didn't happen, simply by decarbonizing our energy and going with green transportation and green power generation, getting away from coal, or, you know, as far as air pollution, those would have tremendous benefits in themselves whether or not climate change happens. It's just simply sort of a wake-up call reminding us that, you know, we really are consuming a lot of energy, and the way we've designed our energy-consumptive urban design and transportation systems, they're making us unhealthy, and it's time that we change those systems and built cities that were good for people on foot and bike rather than in a four-wheel automobile.
Well, as we wrap up, is there anything you'd like to add, a parting thought for our listeners?
You know, I think we're in a very exciting time. I think the awareness of climate change and the potential risks is enormous. I think the issue of energy efficiency, be it for climate change or national security and independence and things like that, we're at a great time to rethink the way we operate in, as far as our energy consumptive lifestyles, because we do consume per person far more than any other country in the world. And this is a great time to recognize that being green is also being healthy in this case. So I think it's really it's a tremendous opportunity that we can really embrace this.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Dr. Jonathan Patz, a world-recognized expert on climate and health from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Dr. Patz, thank you very much for your valuable time.
You're quite welcome, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
What do we like?
Ice caps!
What do we like?
Ice caps!
What do we like?
Ice caps!
There are scientists, and there are great scientists. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy has studied life in Brazil's Amazon since 1965. He's advised the World Bank, the United Nations, and more. Lovejoy heads the Heinz Center for Science, Economics, and the Environment. He started the term biodiversity in science. You are about to hear his latest speech, a keynote introducing 2010 as the UNESCO Year of Biodiversity. It was recorded in Paris January 25th by independent environmental journalist Stephen Leahy and sent that night to Radio EcoShock. Here is Thomas Lovejoy with a plea for the remains of life as the climate shifts.
We are at the start of the sixth major extinction of life on Earth. And the question before humanity is, how far will that be allowed to proceed? I'll talk a little bit at the outset on three points. One on the exploration of life on Earth. Second, on life as the living library for the life sciences, and a little bit on economics. And then I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about climate change, its implications for biological diversity, and how biological diversity has major implications for climate change itself, and indeed could transform, indeed revolutionize how we address climate change. So, exploring life on Earth, a vastly unfinished job, a grand adventure, intellectually and otherwise, one that on the largest scale that it deserves has never quite caught fire, but has really important elements accomplished, like the census of marine life, which we will celebrate and learn about this evening. Suffice it to say, in the course of my own lifetime, the tree of life has changed from being a tree to this low-lying, spreading bush with the higher, so-called higher organisms of plants, animals, and fungi, now three terminal twigs on the upper right, and all the rest of it made up of microorganisms with strange metabolisms and strange appetites deriving from the earliest conditions of life on Earth. Completing the job of exploring biodiversity and giving us the fundamental information of what there is and where it is, so fundamental to managing it wisely, is in fact within our grasp. And Stuart Pym and colleagues have a paper submitted to the PNAS at the moment looking at this for well-known groups such as flowering plants, and this is an illustration of how it comes out with one family, estimating maybe 15% of the species of the Rubiaceae still to be described. And the important point as we think about the future of biodiversity is that most of those will be species with small ranges and probably from hotspot areas. So probably our estimate of the percentage of flowering plants which are endangered needs to be essentially raised to something like 30%. But going on, I'd like to talk a little bit about one aspect of services from biodiversity, which I think has been vastly underplayed and underappreciated. There was no mention of knowledge services in the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. But in the end, since every species represents a set of solutions to a unique set of biological problems, biodiversity collectively and the way it interacts in ecosystems and in larger formats is essentially a living library for the life sciences. So I'll just give you two examples of how this works. One is one of my favorites. It involves the bushmaster, a large poisonous snake from the South American rainforests for which people rarely have warm feelings, especially when you tell them that the venom of the bushmaster causes its victim's blood pressure to go to zero forever. Scientists at Brazil's famous Butantan Institute, some decades back, studying how this venom worked, discovered a whole new system of regulation of blood pressure, the angiotensin system. And while snake venom itself cannot be used as a medicine, knowing that the system existed, pharmaceutical chemists were able to build molecules that play with that system. And that was the origin of the ACE inhibitors, which literally lead to tens of millions of people living longer, healthier, and more productive lives all around the world. Or consider this hot spring in Yellowstone, set aside for its scenic beauty. In 1993, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was given to a laid-back Californian named Carrie Muller for conceiving of the polymerase chain reaction, a reaction that allows one to multiply genetic material thousands of times over in the space of minutes and hours. At the time of this conception, there was no known enzyme resistant to heat, which would be critical to making that chain reaction work. So there was a reaction, but not a chain reaction. And somebody was just smart enough to say, surely somewhere in nature there are organisms that exist at very high temperatures that might have a heat-resistant enzyme that could make this work. And they went to the American Type Culture Collection, sort of a national zoo for microbes in the state of Maryland, and indeed, Thomas Brock, a microbiologist, had deposited a bacterium from the Yellowstone hot springs known as Thermus aquaticus, and it had, in fact, the enzyme that makes the polymerase chain reaction works. The average person reading PCR in the newspaper has no clue about that background. They may not even quite understand what it does. But basically, it has revolutionized diagnostic medicine, forensic medicine, provided the basis for the Human Genome Project. The benefits to humanity are enormous. So I'm just in passing make the point that we undervalue the living library for the life sciences and should be paying it more attention and giving it more publicity.
We'll be right back with the rest of that powerful speech just in from Paris with Dr. Thomas Lovejoy.